Chapter 20. Dominic plied him with questions as to the whereabouts of the Guarda Costas. The preventive service afloat was really the one for us to reckon with, and it was material for our success and safety to know the exact position of the patrol craft in the neighborhood. The news could not have been more favorable. The officer mentioned a small place on the coast some 12 miles off, where, unsuspicious and unready, she was lying at anchor, with her sails unbent, painting yards and scraping spars. Then he left us after the usual compliments, smirking reassuringly over his shoulder. I had kept below pretty close all day from excess of prudence. The stake played on that trip was big. We are ready to go at once, but for Caesar, who has been missing ever since breakfast, announced Dominic to me in his slow, grim way. Where the fellow had gone, and why, we could not imagine. The usual surmises in the case of a missing seaman did not apply to Caesar's absence. He was too odious for love, friendship, gambling, or even casual intercourse. But once or twice he had wandered away like this before. Dominic went ashore to look for him, but returned at the end of 2 hours alone and very angry, as I could see by the token of the invisible smile under his mustache being intensified. We wondered what had become of the wretch, and made a hurried investigation amongst our portable property. He had stolen nothing. He will be back before long, I said confidently. 10 minutes afterwards, one of the men on deck called out loudly. I can see him coming. Caesar had only his shirt and trousers on. He had sold his coat, apparently for pocket money. You knave, was all Dominic said, with a terrible softness of voice. He restrained his choler for a time. Here have you been, vagabond? He asked menacingly. Nothing would induce Caesar to answer that question. It was as if he even disdained to lie. He faced us, drawing back his lips and gnashing his teeth, and did not shrink an inch before the sweep of Dominic's arm. He went down as if shot, of course. But this time I noticed that, when picking himself up, he remained longer than usual on all fours, baring his big teeth over his shoulder, and glaring upwards at his uncle with a new sort of hate in his round, yellow eyes. That permanent sentiment seemed pointed at that moment by his special malice and curiosity. I became quite interested. If he ever manages to put poison in the dishes, I thought to myself, this is how he will look at us as we sit at our meal. But I did not, of course, believe for a moment that he would ever put poison in our food. He ate the same things himself. Moreover, he had no poison. And I could not imagine a human being so blinded by cupidity as to sell poison to such an atrocious creature. XLIV. We slipped out to sea quietly at dusk, and all through the night everything went well. The breeze was gusty, a southerly blow was making up. It was fair wind for our course. Now and then Dominic slowly and rhythmically struck his hands together a few times, as if applauding the performance of the tremolino. The balancel hummed and quivered as she flew along, dancing lightly under our feet. At daybreak I pointed out to Dominic, amongst the several sail in view running before the gathering storm, one particular vessel. The press of canvas she carried made her loom up high and on, like a gray column standing motionless directly in our wake. Look at this fellow, Dominic, I said. He seems to be in a hurry. The padron made no remark, but, wrapping his black cloak close about him, stood up to look. His weather-tanned face, framed in the hood, had an aspect of authority and challenging force, with the deep-set eyes gazing far away fixedly, without a wink, like the intent, merciless, steady eyes of a seabird. C.H.I. va piano va sano, he remarked at last, with a derisive glance over the side, in ironic allusion to our own tremendous speed. The Tremolino was doing her best, and seemed to hardly touch the great burst of foam over which she darted. I crouched down again, to get some shelter from the low bulwark. After more than half an hour of swaying immobility expressing a concentrated breathless watchfulness, Dominic sank on the deck by my side. Within the monkish cowl his eyes gleamed with a fierce expression which surprised me. All he said was, "He has come out here to wash the new paint off his yards, I suppose." "What?" I shouted, getting up on my knees. "S.G. the Guard Acosta?" The perpetual suggestion of a smile under Dominic's piratical mustaches seemed to become more accentuated, quite real, grim, actually almost visible through the wet and uncurled hair. Judging by that symptom, he must have been in a towering rage. But I could also see that he was puzzled, and that discovery affected me disagreeably. Dominic puzzled. For a long time, leaning against the bulwark, I gazed over the stern at the gray column that seemed to stand swaying slightly in our wake, always at the same distance. Meanwhile, Dominic, black and cowled, sat cross-legged on the deck, with his back to the wind, recalling vaguely an Arab chief in his burnous sitting on the sand. Above his motionless figure, the little cord and tassel on the stiff point of the hood swung about inanely in the gale. At last I gave up facing the wind and rain, and crouched down by his side. I was satisfied that the sail was a patrol craft. Her presence was not a thing to talk about, but soon, between two clouds charged with hail showers, a burst of sunshine fell upon her sails, and our men discovered her character for themselves. From that moment I noticed that they seemed to take no heed of each other, or of anything else. They could spare no eyes, and no thought, but for the slight column shape astern of us. Its swaying had become perceptible. For a moment she remained dazzlingly white, then faded away slowly to nothing in a squall, only to reappear again, nearly black, resembling a post stuck upright against the slaty background of solid cloud. Since first noticed this, he had not gained on us a foot. "She will never catch the Tremolino," I said exultingly. Dominic did not look at me. He remarked absently, but justly, that the heavy weather was in our pursuer's favor. She was three times our size. What we had to do was to keep our distance till dark, which we could manage easily, and then haul off to seaward and consider the situation. But his thoughts seemed to stumble in the darkness of some not solved enigma, and soon he fell silent. We ran steadily, wing and wing. Cape San Sebastian nearly ahead seemed to recede from us in the squalls of rain, and come out again to meet our rush, every time more distinct between the showers. For my part, I was by no means certain that this gabaloo, as our men alluded to her opprobriously, was after us at all. There were nautical difficulties in such a view which made me express the sanguine opinion that she was in all innocence simply changing her station. At this Dominic condescended to turn his head. "I tell you she is in chase," he affirmed moodily, after one short glance astern. I never doubted his opinion. But with all the ardor of a neophyte, and the pride of an apt learner, I was at that time a great nautical casuist. "What I can't understand," I insisted subtly, "is how on earth, with this wind, S. he has managed to be just where she was when we first made her out. It is clear that she could not, and did not, gain 12 miles on us during the night. And there are other impossibilities." Dominic had been sitting motionless, like an inanimate black cone posed on the stern deck, near the rudder head, with a small tassel fluttering on its sharp point, and for a time he preserved the immobility of his meditation. Then, bending over with a short laugh, he gave my ear the bitter fruit of it. He understood everything now perfectly. She was where we had seen her first, not because S. he had caught us up, but because we had passed her during the night, while she was already waiting for us, hove to, most likely, on our very track. "Do you understand already?" Dominic muttered in a fierce undertone. "Lady, you know we left a good 8 hours before we were expected to leave, otherwise she would have been in time to lie in wait for us on the other side of the cape," and he snapped his teeth like a wolf close to my face, "and she would have had us like that." I saw it all plainly enough now. They had eyes in their heads, and all their wits about them in that craft. We had passed them in the dark as they jogged uneasily towards their ambush with the idea that we were yet far behind. At daylight, however, sighting a balancella head under a press of canvas, they had made sail in chase. But if that was so, then Dominic seized my arm. Yes, yes. She came out on an information, do you see it? On information. ... We have been sold betrayed. Why? How? What for? We always paid them all so well on shore. ... No. But it is my head that is going to burst. He seemed to choke, tugged at the throat button of the cloak, jumped up open-mouthed, as if to hurl curses and denunciation, but instantly mastered himself, and, wrapping up the cloak closer about him, sat down on the deck again as quiet as ever. Yes, it must be the work of some scoundrel ashore, I observed. He pulled the edge of the hood well forward over his brow before he muttered. A scoundrel. ... Yes. ... It's evident. Well, I said, they can't get us, that's clear. No, he assented quietly, they cannot. We shaved the cape very close to avoid an adverse current. On the other side, by the effect of the land, the wind failed us so completely for a moment that the Tremolino's two great lofty sails hung idle to the masts, in the thundering uproar of the seas breaking upon the shore we had left behind. And when the returning gust filled them again, we saw with amazement half of the new mainsail, which we thought fit to drive the boat under before giving way, absolutely fly out of the bolt ropes. We lowered the yard at once, and saved it all, but it was no longer a sail, it was only a heap of soaked strips of canvas cumbering the deck and weighting the craft. Dominic gave the order to throw the whole lot overboard. I would have had the yard thrown overboard too, he said, leading me aft again, if it had not been for the trouble. Let no sign escape you, he continued, lowering his voice, but I am going to tell you something terrible. Listen. I have observed that the roping stitches on that sail have been cut. You hear? Cut with a knife in many places. And yet it stood all that time. Not enough cut. That flap did it at last. What matters it? But look. There's treachery seated on this very deck. By the horns of the devil. Seated here at our very backs. Do not turn, Signorin. We were facing aft then. What's to be done? I asked, appalled. Nothing. Silence. Be a man, Signorin. What else? I said. To show I could be a man, I resolved to utter no sound as long as Dominic himself had the force to keep his lips closed. Nothing but silence becomes certain situations. Moreover, the experience of treachery seemed to spread a hopeless drowsiness over my thoughts and senses. For an hour more we watched our pursuer surging out nearer and nearer from amongst the squalls that sometimes hid her altogether. But even when not seen, we felt her there like a knife at our throats. She gained on us frightfully. And the Tremolino, in a fierce breeze and in much smoother water, swung uneasily under her one sail, with something appallingly careless in the joyous freedom of her motion. Another half hour went by. I could not stand it any longer. They will get the poor barkey, I stammered out suddenly, almost on the verge of tears. Dominic stirred no more than a carving. A sense of catastrophic loneliness overcame my inexperienced soul. The vision of my companions passed before me. The whole royalist gang was in Monte Carlo now, I reckoned. And they appeared to me clear-cut and very small, with affected voices and stiff gestures, like a procession of rigid marionettes upon a toy stage. I gave a start. What was this? A mysterious, remorseless whisper came from within the motionless black hood at my side. Il fall la tour. I heard it very well. What do you say, Dominic? I asked, moving nothing but my lips. And the whisper within the hood repeated mysteriously, she must be killed. My heart began to beat violently. That's it, I faltered out. At how? You love her well? I do. Then you must find the heart for that work too. You must steer her yourself, and I shall see to it that she dies quickly, without leaving as much as a chip behind. Can you? I murmured, fascinated by the black hood turned immovably over the stern, as if in unlawful communion with that old sea of magicians, slave dealers, exiles and warriors, the sea of legends and terrors, where the mariners of remote antiquity used to hear the restless shade of an old wanderer weep aloud in the dark. "I know a rock," whispered the initiated voice within the hood secretly. "A caution. It must be done before our men perceive what we are about. Whom can we trust now? A knife drawn across the fore halyards would bring the foresail down, and put an end to our liberty in 20 minutes. And the best of our men may be afraid of drowning. There is our little boat, but in an affair like this no one can be sure of being saved." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.